is Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. It's mid-August. There's still plenty of summer left. Hopefully, you're enjoying a slightly more relaxed pace at the office, which frees you up to take part in activities you enjoy. Whether it's an intense game of tennis or a more cerebral pursuit, I think you'll enjoy today's focus on the games people play. We'll cover new books on basketball, baseball, tennis, and soccer greats, and focus on some more sedentary but incredibly popular pastimes. My guest today, Alan Connor, is a popular British TV quizmaster. He's just written the most fascinating book on crosswords. Trust me, even if you're not hooked on finding the right answer to 3 across or 12 down, you'll be intrigued by the history and the lore. Let the games begin as we turn to page 1 of the book report. Could any of us have predicted our total entrancement with this year's World Cup? The book report is pleased to start today's show with a focus on the world's most popular sport, written by the greatest player of all time, Pelé. In Why Soccer Matters, the legendary star, ambassador, and humanitarian shares a global vision for what soccer can accomplish. Before Ronaldo, before Beckham, there was Edson Arantes do Nascimento, known simply as Pelé. A national treasure, he created pure magic with his accomplishments on the field. 3 unprecedented World Cup championships, and 1,283 goals in his 20-year career. For the first time, Pelé, with Brian Winter, explores the recent history of the game and provides insights into soccer's role connecting and galvanizing players around the world. He's been a global ambassador for soccer, oft-times in support of charitable organizations such as UNICEF, promoting the positive influences soccer can have to transform young men and women in struggling communities. With unparalleled openness, he shares his most inspiring experiences, heartwarming stories, and hard-won wisdom. Sean Pratt narrates.
My earliest memories of soccer are of pickup games on our street, weaving through small brick houses and potholed dirt roads, scoring goals and laughing like crazy between gasps of cold, heavy air. We would play for hours, until our feet hurt, and the sun went down and our mothers called us back inside. No fancy gear, no expensive jerseys, just a ball, or something like it. Therein lies much of the beauty of the game. As for what I did with that ball, well, I learned almost everything I know from my father, João Ramos do Nascimento. Like virtually everyone in Brazil, he was known by his nickname, Dondino. Dondino was from a small town in the state of Minas Gerais, literally, General Mines, where much of Brazil's gold was found during colonial times. When Dondino met my mother, Celeste, he was still performing his mandatory military service. She was in school at the time. They married when she was just 15. By 16, she was pregnant with me. They gave me the name Edson after Thomas Edison because when I was born in 1940, the electric light bulb had only recently come to their town. They were so impressed that they wanted to pay homage to its inventor. It turned out they missed a letter, but I've always loved the name anyway. Dondino took his soldiering seriously, but soccer was his true passion. He was 6 feet tall, huge for Brazil, especially in those days, and very skilled with the ball. He had a particular talent for jumping high into the air and scoring goals with his head, something he once did an amazing 5 times in one game. That probably was, and is, a national record. Years later, people would say, with some exaggeration, the only goal-scoring record in Brazil that doesn't belong to Pelé is held by his own father. It was no coincidence. I'm certain that Dondino could have been one of the all-time Brazilian greats. He just never got a chance to prove it. When I was born, my dad was playing semi-professional ball in a town in Minas Gerais called Três Corações, 3 Hearts in English. Truth be told, it wasn't much of a living. While a few elite soccer clubs paid decent salaries back then, the vast majority didn't. So being a soccer player carried a certain stigma. It was like being a dancer, or an artist, or any profession that people pursue out of love, not because there's any real money in it. Our young family drifted from town to town, always in search of the next paycheck. At one point, we spent a whole year living in a hotel, but not quite the luxury kind, let's say. It was, as we later joked, a zero-star resort for soccer players, as well as traveling salesmen and outright bums. Right before my second birthday in 1942, it looked like all that sacrifice would finally pay off. Nonino got what appeared to be his big break. He was called up to play for Atletico Mineiro, the biggest and richest club in all of Minas Gerais. This was finally a soccer job that could support all of our family, maybe comfortably. My dad was just 25. He had his whole playing career in front of him. But during his very first match against São Cristóvão, a team from Rio, disaster struck when Dondino collided at full speed with an opposing defender named Augusto. That was not the last we heard of Augusto, who would recover and go on to other things. But it was sadly the high point of Dondino's playing career. He catastrophically damaged his knee, the ligaments, perhaps the meniscus. I say perhaps because there were no MRIs back then, no real sports medicine to speak of at all in Brazil, in fact. We didn't really know what was wrong, much less how to treat it. All we knew was to put ice on whatever hurt, elevate it, and hope for the best. Needless to say, Dondino's knee would never fully heal. Unable to make it on the field for his second game, Dondino was quickly cut from the team and sent back home to Três Corações. Thus began the true journeyman years, a period that would see our family constantly struggling to make ends meet.
We've just heard Why Soccer Matters by Pelé with Brian Winter. Roland Lazenby's Michael Jordan, The Life, is being named one of 2014's most riveting bios. When most people think of Michael Jordan, they think of the beautiful shots, nothing but net, his body in total sync with the ball. Jordan is responsible for moments so ingrained in basketball history, they have their own names. The shrug, the shot, the flu game. But for all his greatness, there's also a dark side to Jordan. Drawing on personal relationships with Jordan's coaches, the author's own career in the trenches covering Jordan in college and in the pros, plus interviews with friends, teammates, family members, and Jordan himself, Lazenby provides a truly definitive study of Jordan. Bob Sauer narrates.
Jordan himself considered the question in those early months of his pro career, after viewing videotape of himself. Was I flying? He asked. It sure seemed like it, at least for a short time. The rarest talent is like a comet streaking briefly across the sky, captured only by the trailing flash of its brilliance. Michael Jordan's entire mesmerizing playing career left fans, the media, his former coaches and teammates, even Jordan himself, still struggling to comprehend what had happened years after he last played. Sometimes I wonder what it will be like to look back on all of this, he once observed, whether it will even seem real. Was it real? The time would come in his later years when a plumper Jordan with a drawn face would find himself the target of great ridicule and internet invective over his missteps as an executive or his personal shortcomings. Yet even that couldn't dim the light he had cast as a player, when he was nothing short of otherworldly. In the beginning, he was simply Mike Jordan, just another adolescent from North Carolina with an uncertain future, contemplating a stint in the Air Force after high school. The early 1980s marked his startling transformation into Michael, the Archangel of the Rims. In the process, his persona propelled the rise of Nike's business empire, which soon made him its young emperor. A role that both freed and imprisoned him. He became the very picture of competence. Nobody, it seemed, could do anything quite as well as Michael Jordan played basketball. His competence was exceeded only by his confidence, noted longtime Chicago sportswriter Lacey Banks. The professional game had always struggled against its gritty image, grown men running around in what amounted to underwear. But Jordan elevated all of that with his flight. It was subtle at first, the element of cool he brought to the sport. He soon enough infatuated a worldwide audience, just as American television programming was reaching the apex of its influence. For a generation, his impossibly fetching 1991 Gatorade commercial quickly came to serve as a soundtrack, a mantra. Sometimes I dream that he is me. You've got to see that's how I dream to be, if I could be like Mike. The convergence of culture and technology had thrust him into this unparalleled role as the soaring godhead of a global sports and merchandising empire who left just about everyone agog at his spectacle. Art Chansky, the basketball writer who had covered Jordan as something of a regular Joe at the University of North Carolina, recalled his surprise later upon visiting him in Chicago. "I was just amazed in old Chicago Stadium when he had to walk down the aisle between the baseline seats behind the basket to get to the floor. Just the effect he would have on people as he walked by. Grown men and women. You know how much they had to make just to afford those seats to begin with? Just the fact that Michael was within a couple feet of them. I watched their faces, the contortions. It was like the Messiah walking by. Then, in the locker room afterward, the press would be like 10 deep around him. Messiah, indeed. The worship grew so fearsome over the seasons that longtime Bulls PR man Tim Hallam began referring to Jordan as Jesus. Hallam would turn to a publicity assistant and ask, "Have you seen Jesus today?" This evolution had been propelled by a seemingly unshakable good fortune. Ralph Sampson competed memorably against Jordan in college when both were vying to be named the National College Player of the Year, and he watched with fascination his opponents rise over the ensuing decades. "Yes, Jordan had all of the physical gifts and an unparalleled work ethic," Sampson acknowledged, "but Jordan's abundance of luck could not be overlooked. He was blessed with the best coaches and joined by great teammates. I mean, he worked at the game, and if he wasn't good at something, he had the motivation to be the best at it," Sampson observed in a 2012 interview on the eve of his own selection for the Hall of Fame. "But he also got put in the right situation with the right team, the right coaches that saw his talent and ability, and they put a team around him that worked. So I think it's the combination of all that that has made him." No one was more aware of the extraordinary chain of events that drove his life than Jordan himself. "Timing is everything," he offered, looking back as he neared age 50. Yet timing and luck were merely the foundation of the mystery. Sports psychologist George Mumford was transfixed the first time he observed Jordan's animated approach to practice at age 32.
We've just heard Michael Jordan, The Life, by Roland Lazenby. Alan Connor is a British comedy writer, TV presenter, and quizmaster. He has a weekly column on crosswords in The Guardian, and he writes for the BBC on language and the arts. The Oxford-educated Connor has written The Crossword Century, 100 years of witty wordplay, ingenious puzzles, and linguistic mischief. One reviewer commented, "If you love language and history and marvel at the genius of puzzles, codes, and game design, Alan Connor's deep dive into the crossword will keep you smiling and eagerly turning pages." Let's meet him now. Welcome, Alan, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
I learned in your book the first crossword appeared on December 21st, 1913. Introduce us to Arthur Wynne and fill in those little boxes.
Dear Arthur Wynne, yes, the unlikely inventor of something he didn't know was going to be as big as it was. So Arthur Wynne was British. He was from Liverpool, which gives the British some claim to have invented the crossword. But I think it really is an American invention because Arthur Wynne's father was a newspaper editor. He wanted to work in journalism and he thought he'd try his hand in the New World. So along with a lot of other people at the turn of the century, he went off to find his fortune. He did end up writing for a newspaper, the New York World, Randolph Hearst's newspaper, but it wasn't exactly journalism that he was doing. He was stuck, you might say, in a section called Fun, which was the Sunday section of puzzles and silliness. And come 1913, they decided they would increase the size of Fun for the Christmas edition. And so Arthur had to think of some more fun than normal. He tried things like word searches and things like that. But if he didn't fill that space, I guess he would have been fired. So he had a good incentive to be inventive. I didn't mean to rhyme there. And so he came up with a thing that he called a word cross. There was no real language to describe what he wanted people to do. So there was this funny little diamond of little squares with an instruction that said, fill in the small spaces with the words which correspond to the following definitions, something like that. It was very interesting to look at it and see that they didn't even have words like clue then, because he was just making it up as he went along, like lots of the best inventions, I suppose.
I loved reading how Simon & Schuster and then Margaret Farrer figured into the puzzle. Tell us about that.
Yes, so Arthur was ploughing a lonely furrow for a while. His puzzles were popular, but they just stayed in that one newspaper on Sundays until Simon & Schuster came along. So they decided they wanted to have a publishing company, and they set up the company. All they were missing was the manuscripts. And at a loss of what to do, one of them discovered that his niece was hooked on these puzzles that Arthur Wynne did, and that Margaret Farrar, Mother Petherbridge, as she was then, was editing. And so they thought, well, just to sort of get things going, we could do a book of these puzzles, but let's not use the name Simon & Schuster for that, because our aspirations are a bit greater than just a book of trivial old puzzles. So they took the name of their telephone exchange and used that as an alias, Plaza Publishing, and printed up some books of puzzles, not knowing what would happen next. And by the end of the year, they topped the New York Times bestseller list, I think, three or four times. And America was very much into its fads in the 1920s. So by the end of the decade, and certainly 1925, they were a full-blown fad. And Simon & Schuster poached this young woman called Margaret, who being a woman, had been told that she could check that the answers were correct in the crossword. That was her contribution. And what she then did was apply quite a steely eye, I suppose, to the puzzle and to the form of the crossword puzzle. And she had quite a good, critical, keen sense of what solvers found satisfying and didn't find satisfying, looking at things like whether words should be longer than two letters, the symmetry of the grid, the kind of language that's in there. And over the time, as she did these puzzles, first for the Simon & Schuster collections and latterly for the New York Times, she did as much as Arthur Wynne did, I think, to refine the puzzle into the form that we know and enjoy so much now.
Let's talk about history for a bit. You've said that the double acrostic was a precursor. What is that exactly?
Well, that's a good question. It's a sort of baffling Victorian hobby or way of wasting time that appeared in newspapers and magazines and periodicals in Victorian times, where I suppose it was a bit like a crossword in that there were clues, but what you had to do was take the first and last letters of the answers of a series of clues, and then they would spell out two more words which gave you your answer. I think part of the reason why they did that, why the answers were just two words rather than a whole grid, was that the printing technology of the 19th century wasn't really up to producing grids and small type in little newspapers.
We're speaking with Alan Connor on the Book Report. The Nina has a charming past. Will you share that?
I'd love to share that. I think sometimes these people who construct puzzles are very, very bright. And so after a few years of constructing puzzles, you know, fitting the words together, coming up with the best clues that they can, coming up with interesting words, they sort of they want more, like any addict. They want a kind of bigger hit. And so what you find sometimes is that there are extra words hidden in the grid that aren't actually even entries, that they'll run across the bars or between the black squares or on diagonals or in funny places. Or sometimes a constructor might decide that he's going to make the first letters of all of the clues spell out some extra message, which is an extra constraint, obviously. But once you're the kind of warp genius who's good at doing these things, then it becomes part of the fun for them. For it to be a Nina, I suppose it has to be not flagged up to the reader, to the solver. It has to be something the solver spots by accident or wonders why the grid is going in a certain way. People would contact newspapers and say, I'd like to propose to my girlfriend, but I'd like to surprise her by that proposal appearing in your crossword paper, in the crossword in your newspaper. So it's all sorts of things can appear in there. In Britain recently, they've actually been sort of political messages have appeared there with all the scandals surrounding the Murdoch newspapers as one of them. The Sun and the News of the World were hitting their trouble. It was thought that the crossword compilers there had fitted some unflattering messages about their bosses into the final edition.
And why was it called Nina?
That's a bit of, I suppose you could call it solver patter, in that solvers like to kind of have chats about puzzles and what they've spotted. And one person who enjoyed talking about these hidden messages also enjoyed the cartoons of Al Hirschfeld, who used to do cartoons for The New Yorker and publications like that. And after he had his first child, a daughter called Nina, he decided he would hide her name in most of the illustrations that he did. So it might be just that the curls of someone's hair, or in the lines that make up the kind of folds of a dress, a long robe as it hits the floor, if you looked at it carefully, you might just see a little N, and then an I, and then an N, and an A.
I think a lot of us wonder, for example, Will Shortz, does he create the New York Times crossword puzzle every day? Does he use a computer? How does he do it?
How does he do it? Practice, I would say. He has a team. I think it's probably very hard to get onto his team, because everyone who constructs puzzles would love to see them appear in the Times. But he has a team of people who send them in, and at that point, I think they become joint efforts. He's a hands-on editor, so he'll have a look. He'll be applying some of those criteria set down by the mother of modern crosswording, and he might rewrite clues, or he might send the puzzle back to the constructor. My understanding is he doesn't sort of have enough time nowadays with all of his commitments to sit and construct an entire puzzle from scratch, but his signature is certainly there on every puzzle that's there in the Times.
Give us the backstory of the Homer Simpson's puzzle.
My all-time favorite puzzle. I would say the greatest puzzle of the first century of crosswording was one which people would have encountered in a very strange way. When I was digging around, looking at this Homer Simpson puzzle, I wanted to make sure that I understood America in the way that I thought I did. So I asked some of the Simpsons writers, do you think there's a fair overlap between the sort of person who sits down on a Sunday morning to solve the New York Times puzzle on that day, and the sort of person who will watch The Simpsons on a Sunday evening? And I was assured that I was right, that there is an overlap there. And the people in that overlap will have had a very odd surprise, in that a few years back, they may well have sat down and solved a puzzle and thought nothing more particularly of it, until watching The Simpsons that evening, and watching an episode in which Lisa becomes afflicted by a love of crossword puzzles, and is so hooked on them that she goes in for a tournament. She later finds out that Homer has bet against her, and can't believe what a bad father he is yet again, and Homer has to make it up to her. So what he does is he contacts Will Shortz, who has a cameo appearance in the puzzle, and asks him to put an apology in puzzle form in the New York Times. So if you've solved this puzzle, what happened to you, and I suppose some people listening may remember this, is you watch Lisa solve what you take to be a fictional puzzle that was created by The Simpsons team, and what you then start to realise is that's exactly the same puzzle I did this morning. Mm. These people have been talking to each other. This fictional puzzle has appeared in sort of flesh and blood form on my breakfast table this morning.
Can you share some stories about famous crossworders, those folks who were just passionate about it?
Well, there's so many, I suppose. There's Norman Mailer. I love the expression he used to describe his addiction to crosswords, which was, he said, this is how I comb my brain every morning. And he was also disappointed that his name didn't appear more often in crosswords, because he thought Mailer was probably quite a good word for crossword setters, because it's got those A's, and it's got an A and an I and an E, and crossword setters need lots of those.
Will you be dissecting a different kind of puzzle in the near future? What's next for you?
For me, I've taken a turn towards quizzes and trivia. I found myself with a job of doing the questions for what's supposed to be the BBC's hardest quiz show, which is called Only Connect. And it's really got me thinking about how on earth do you know whether one question is harder than another? I knew it would be a challenge, but then it became sort of part of my job of sitting there, you know, looking at two pieces of information and saying that piece of information, I bet fewer people know that or would be able to remember it with a clock ticking under studio lights than that one. And so I took that thought for a walk and thought, well, I bet there's as much interesting stuff to be said about the world of trivia and why people suddenly started answering questions for fun in the last century, as I'd found around the world of crossword puzzles. So I hope that's what's next for me, is a look at what our brains are doing when we answer trivia questions, and whether that's changed now that none of us bothers to remember anything anymore because we can just look it up.
Alan, I found your book really fascinating, and I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I've had an absolute blast.
All right. Bye now.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Jeff Ryan's Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America, is the story of the company's rise and the rise of the beloved icon who made it all possible. Nintendo set the standard for video game innovation in America, starting in 1981 with a plucky hero who jumped over barrels to save a girl from an ape. The saga of Mario, the portly plumber who became the most successful franchise in the history of gaming, has plot twists worthy of a video game. Jeff Ryan shares the story of how this quintessentially Japanese company found success in the American market. Lawsuits, Hollywood, diehard fans, and face-offs with Sony and Microsoft are all part of the drama. Ray Porter narrates.
My own Mario memories probably aren't too different from anyone else's. My first experience was with the cardboard box the NES came in, rather than any game. A schoolmate brought it on the bus every day to show off, and we crowded around to look at the screenshots on its obverse side. A few months later, our parents bought us an NES, and my brothers and I put it through usage that would put a Miami air conditioner to shame. We traded games with neighbors, kids older and younger than us, even traded out of the middle school caste system with the cool kids. We started a neighborhood fan club. To get in, you had to beat a game and find a secret. Most everyone's secrets were from Super Mario Brothers, which had them in spades. Then high school and college and life happened, and I stopped gaming, save for a PC shooter once a year or so. I never chose to quit gaming, it just fell off my priorities list. Then, about 10 years ago, I landed a copy editing job at a .com. No one had any copy for me to proof before noon, yet I was coming in at 8:30 a.m. I asked my managing editor if there was anything I could write to help out. There was. She gave me a press release about a Pokemon tournament. The company had been using a freelancer for its irregular reporting of video game news and reviews. Having me write for this section of the site would bolster that coverage, and for free, since I was salaried. I typed up the piece, handed it in, and a few minutes later heard my editor on the phone firing the freelancer. She said they had just hired a new video game expert. Gulp. In the months that followed, I studied video games in a way very few others have. I wasn't actually playing them since I was at work. I wasn't designing them either, so I didn't need to know alias coding or texture mapping. I needed to know why they were popular. What made one title better or cooler than the next? I made myself an expert in all things Sega, Sony, and Nintendo. And just about all things Nintendo, I found out, were connected to Mario. He was everywhere, in sports games, fighting games, role-playing games, puzzle games, racing games, and every bit of branding imaginable. He had become a one-word shortcut for Nintendo, for gaming itself, and, I'm sure Nintendo hoped, for the concept of fun. Streets were named after him. There was even an unofficial holiday for him on March 10th, M-A-R-1-O. Get it? Super Mario has become the default nickname for any Mario. Formula One champion Mario Andretti, born in 1940, sometimes gets asked if he's named after Super Mario. He says he is, to the delight of the 7-year-olds who ask. Chef Mario Batali is called Super Mario as well. If you're good at a professional sport and your name is Mario, you know what your nickname will be. Just ask hockey's Mario Lemieux, football's Mario Williams, Ultimate Fighting's Mario Miranda, cycling's Mario Cipollini, and soccer's Mario Basler, Mario Gomez, and Mario Balotelli. They are, respectively, Canadian, American, Brazilian, Italian, German, Spanish, and Ghanaese. The nickname cannot be avoided wherever on the globe you are a Mario. At some point, I realized that the life story of Super Mario is the history of gaming itself. Yes, it's a history of Nintendo and its creators, designer Shigeru Miyamoto, billionaire Hiroshi Yamauchi, and his underestimated son-in-law Minoru Arakawa. But at its core, it's the biography of a man who's not real, but has a Q rating up there with Mickey Mouse, a figure whose specific tale of the tape, pudgy Italian plumber from Brooklyn, merely serves to make him as perpetual an underdog as that under-tall Italian boxer from Philadelphia, Rocky Balboa.
We've just heard Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America, by Jeff Ryan. The World of Warcraft has millions of fans. So the Book Report, always willing to experiment, will take the plunge with a new title in the series, War Crimes. The brutal siege of Orgrimmar is over. Alliance and Horde forces have stripped Garrosh Hellscream, one of the most reviled figures on Azeroth, of his title as War Chief. His thirst for conquest devastated cities, nearly tore the Horde apart, and destroyed countless lives throughout the World of Warcraft. Now, on the legendary continent of Pandoria, he will stand trial for his transgressions. Renowned leaders from across the world have gathered to witness this historic event. As the trial unfolds, agents of the Bronze Dragonflight present shocking visions of Garrosh's atrocities. For many of those in attendance, these glimpses into history force them to relive painful memories and even question their own innocence or guilt. For others, the chilling details stoke the flames of their hatred. Scott Brick narrates.
It looks too peaceful and beautiful to be the prison of someone so horrible, Lady Jaina Proudmoore mused as she approached the Temple of the White Tiger. She, the Blue Dragon Kalikos, Ranger General Varisa Windrunner, and King Varian Wrynn rode in a cart drawn by a steady-footed yak, whose fluffy fur indicated the beast had been freshly bathed. In acknowledgement of the honored status of the passengers, the cart had been upholstered with silk cushions in vibrant shades, though the travelers did bounce a bit when a wheel hit a rut. "Better than he deserves," said Varisa. She fixed her gaze on Varian. "You should not have stopped Goel from killing him, Your Majesty. There is no other justice for that monster than death, and even that is more merciful than what he has done." The Ranger General's voice was sharp, and Jaina couldn't blame her, especially as she completely shared Varisa's sentiments. Garrosh Hellscream had been responsible for the destruction. No, that was too kind, too clinical a word for what he'd done, the obliteration of the city-state of Theramore. The deaths of hundreds, all occurring in the space of a heartbeat, could be laid at his feet. The then war chief of the Horde had contrived to trick several of the Alliance's finest generals and admirals into assembling at Theramore, where they planned for the sort of warfare that involved an honest fight. Instead, Garrosh had dropped a mana bomb, its power magnified by an artifact stolen from a Blue Dragonflight into the heart of the city. Everyone, everything in the bomb's blast radius had died. Jaina shook her head to clear the awful memory of precisely how some of them, people she loved, had been killed. Jaina Proudmoore would never again be the Lady of Theramore. A gentle touch on her arm brought her back to the present. Jaina looked up at the blue dragon Kalikos, who had been the one good thing to come out of the disaster. He and Jaina might never have found one another if he had not come to Theramore asking for her aid in recovering the focusing iris. If the tides of war had brought Jaina a loving companion, they had borne away that of Varisa Windrunner. Ronin, the archmage who had held Jaina's present title of leader of the Kirin Tor, had stood at the heart of the city, pulling the mana bomb to himself in order to magically contain the blast as best he could. In the process, he had forcibly pushed Jaina through a portal to safety. Jaina, Varisa, the Night Elf, Chandris Feathermoon, and a few of her sentinels had been the only survivors. The leader of the Silver Covenant had never, likely would never, truly recovered from the loss. Varisa had always been strong and outspoken, but now her words were barbed, and a hatred cold and bitter as the ice of Northrend dwelt in her heart. Thank the light. The ice thawed when she spoke to her twin sons, Ghirimar and Galadin. Not so long ago, Varian might have risen to the bait and grown angry with Varisa for her open condemnation of his choice. Now he merely said, "You may yet get your wish, Varisa. Remember what Tyran Zhu promised." After Varian had prevented Goel, formerly hailed as Thrall, once war chief of the Horde and now leader of the shamanic order known as Earthenring, from dealing Garrosh the death blow with the mighty Doomhammer, Garrosh had been delivered into the paws of the Pandaren, a people whom both Horde and Alliance trusted, and who had endured their share of harm at Garrosh's hands. Terran Zhu, Lord of the Shadowpan, had assured them that Garrosh would be tried, and justice would be meted out to all. The orc was presently imprisoned in the cellars beneath the Temple of the White Tiger under heavy guard, and 2 days ago word had come from the Celestial Shuan's own emissary. "We request your presence at my temple. Garrosh Hellscream's fate shall be decided." Nothing more.
We've just heard World of Warcraft: War Crimes by Christy Golden. Jimmy Connors has been called a working man's hero, a champion who could tear the cover off a tennis ball, just as he tore the cover off the country club gentility of his sport. A renegade from the wrong side of the tracks, Connors broke the rules with a radically aggressive style of play and bad boy antics that turned his matches into prize fights. In 1974 alone, he won 95 out of 99 matches, all of them while wearing the same white shorts he washed in the sink of his hotel bathrooms. Though he lived the rock star life away from tennis, his enduring dedication to his craft earned him 8 Grand Slam singles titles and kept him among the top 10 best players in the world for 16 straight years, 5 at number one. In The Outsider, Connors tells the uncensored story of his life and career, setting the record straight about his formidable mother Gloria, his very public romance with America's sweetheart Chris Everett, his famous opponents including Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe, Arthur Ashe, Yvonne Lendl, and Rod Laver, and his young nemesis Andre Agassi. Connors also reveals how his issues with obsessive-compulsive disorder, dyslexia, gambling, and the ladies threatened to derail his career and his marriage to Playboy playmate Patty Maguire. Rich Orlow performs this grand slam of a memoir.
When I'm with my family, I feel like I'm sliding the tennis. When I'm practicing, I feel like I'm sliding my family. When I get up at 6:30 a.m., Brett is eating breakfast and watching the Smurfs. I want to spend time with him, but I know I have work to do on the court. When I'm playing tennis, I feel I should be spending time at the pool with Brett and Patty. There are conflicts everywhere I turn. When friends visit, I want to go out and have fun with them, stay out late. But then I'm slighting both my tennis and my family. If I go down to the restaurant for breakfast, I'll see 10 people I'm obliged to say hello to, and that will hold up my day. Mom is on the phone. I talk to her at least 10 times a day. This may sound like a lot, but Mom is also my business manager. My schedule is made 6 months in advance, so not only is she checking in as a mother, mother-in-law, and grandmother, she is letting me know about commercial offers, upcoming tournaments, and all the numerous details involved in my career. If any of the calls last more than a few seconds, it's because she knows I'm having problems. She's concerned about me. I have to push myself further than I want to, train harder, practice longer. I'm older, and things don't come as easily now. I don't mind the physical part. It's getting into the right mental state that I find tough. I haven't been winning the way I expect to, but I have to find a way to act as if I am, so I won't talk myself out of it. I don't want to fall into that trap of saying, oh, maybe they're right. Maybe I am finished. I have to find my self-confidence, even though I'm not sure where I left it. Things aren't working out for me, so to get myself through it, I have to be twice as arrogant. That's how I'll cope. I can't go out there and just be half. I've got to go all the way. I have to be prepared. I have to be in the best shape possible, and my game has to be ready. Wembley, England, November 14th, 1981. Wembley is a big tournament at the end of the year, but it isn't the Grand Slam. And yet, this isn't just another match. I'm down two sets to love, looking across the court at John McEnroe. I love playing Borg, Lendl, Nastasi, Panada, and Gerulaitis. The list of great players from my era is as long as my arm, but to play Mac is beyond the realm of just tennis. He's my gauge. I look to him to see the level I have to reach to be number one again. Mac is the best player in the world. He's just won Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. When McEnroe was coming up, he wanted everything that I had. I was number one in the United States, and he wanted that. I was number one in the world, and he wanted that. Then he took it all, and now I want it back. I'm not just going to roll over and say it's too tough, that he's too young, 7 years younger to be exact. Even though Mac and I clash at every turn, we're so much alike it's scary. I'm Irish, he's Irish. I'm left-handed, he's left-handed. I've got a bad attitude, he's got a bad attitude. I've always said I would love to play myself, and Mac is as close to playing me as I'm going to get. This McEnroe match could be my return to winning in a big way. I know my game is getting better again, and now I have a chance to prove it by beating Mac in the final. Unfortunately, I'm down two sets to love. All I can do is to figure out how to stay out there one more minute, one more point, one more ball, one more anything to keep putting some pressure on Mac. That's all I want to do. I made my reputation on my all-out aggressive style of play, and I'm going to live or die again today with that. I'm not just going to wait for something to happen. I'm going to force the action. But right now, I'm not in it. Mac is the show. He's doing everything right. And I'm like a bit player in his future Broadway production of Kicking Connors. I'm getting steamrolled. But in tennis, sometimes even the smallest thing can change the course of a match.
We've just heard The Outsider by Jimmy Connors. Capturing the spirit of a freewheeling era, Kevin Cook's rollicking Titanic Thompson, the man who bet on everything, brings to life the gambler hero who inspired Guys and Dolls. Cook, a former Sports Illustrated editor, follows the legend from his modest Arkansas beginnings to his emergence as the most respected hustler in America. Born in 1892 in a log cabin in the Ozarks, Alvin Titanic Thompson traveled with his golf clubs, a .45 revolver, and a suitcase full of cash. He won and lost millions playing cards, dice, golf, pool, and dangerous games of his own invention. He killed 5 men and married 5 women, each one a teenager on her wedding day. He ruled New York's underground craps games in the 1920s and was Damon Runyon's model for slick-talking Skye Masterson. Dominating the links in the pre-PGA Tour years, Thompson teed up with Ben Hogan, Sam Snead, Lee Trevino, and Ray Floyd. He also traded card tricks with Houdini, conned Al Capone, and lost a million to Minnesota Fats. Joe Barrett narrates.
He blew into town like a rogue wind that lifted girls' skirts and turned gamblers' pockets inside out. Tall and thin, with a bland mask of a face, he had close-set eyes that looked a little dead, at least until he offered you a bet. Then those dark eyes sparked, and he smiled like he had good news. "Are you a gambling man?" he'd ask. "Because I am." Alvin was his name, but nobody called him that. They called him Titanic. Titanic Thompson. A made-up name for a self-made man who won and lost millions of dollars playing cards, dice, pool, golf, horseshoes, and anything else he could think of to bet on. He also killed 5 men. But they'd all tell you they had it coming. He also married 5 women, each one a teenager on her wedding day. Titanic liked his women young and pretty, his cars big and fast, his suckers rich and gullible. He spent 50 years roaming America's back roads, living by his wits and reflexes, until America changed and there was no more room for such a man.
That was Titanic Thompson by Kevin Cook. Jackie Robinson heroically broke the color barrier in 1947. But when did true integration of the sport actually occur? Brilliantly researched, Bill Madden, the popular New York Daily News sports writer, puts the spotlight on 1954, the year Willie Mays and the first generation of black superstars changed Major League Baseball forever. Madden's titles features original interviews with key players and weaves together the narrative of one of baseball's greatest seasons against the backdrop of the year's racially charged events. David Drummond narrates.
After their historic signing of Robinson from the Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro Leagues in 1946, the Dodgers, under the direction of their visionary general manager, Branch Rickey, were the most aggressive team in 1954 in bringing black players to the big leagues, with 6. Robinson, catcher Roy Campanella, pitchers Don Newcomb and Joe Black, outfielder Sandy Amoros, and second baseman Jim Gilliam. Next were the Cleveland Indians with 5, center fielder Larry Doby, first baseman Luke Easter, pitcher Dave Hoskins, and outfielders Dave Pope and Al Smith, and then the New York Giants with 4. Outfielders Willie Mays, who was returning from 2 years in the Army, and Monty Irvin, the aforementioned Hank Thompson, who had been subsequently released by the Browns, and Gomez, the Puerto Rican right-handed pitcher who the Yankees had previously released before he could reach the big leagues. It would also not be long into the 54 season when 2 other first-year black players, Banks of the Cubs and 20-year-old Henry Aaron with the Milwaukee Braves, began establishing themselves as future stars with uncommon power. But although there could be little argument about the impact the black players had had on those 3 teams, the Dodgers won 4 pennants and finished 2nd the other 3 times with Robinson and company over those 7 years. The Giants won the pennant in 51, Mays' rookie year, then slumped to 2nd and 5th the next 2 years without him, and the Indians won the World Championship in Doby's rookie year of 1948 and finished 2nd behind the Yankees in 51, 52, and 53 as the All-Star center fielder came into his own, there was still staunch resistance from teams, especially in the American League, led by the Yankees, to integrate. In addition, 7 years later, after Robinson's breakthrough, there remained an unspoken, unwritten quota, just like the color line itself in baseball, as to the number of black players clubs could have on their 25-man roster, a quota that would have severe consequences for the Dodgers in 1954 regarding one of their top minor league prospects, Roberto Clemente. By their sheer dominance, 18 pennants and 16 world championships from 1926 to 53, and a superior scouting staff who for over a quarter century had mined an incomparable gallery of future Hall of Fame talent, from Lou Gehrig in their own backyard at Columbia to Joe DiMaggio and Tony Lazzuri in San Francisco, Bill Dickey in Little Rock, Arkansas, Yogi Berra in St. Louis, Mickey Mantle in Oklahoma, and dozens of other perennial all-stars, the Yankees did not see a need to drastically change course or their philosophy in the procuring of ballplayers. "We are not against bringing a Negro player to the major leagues," insisted Yankees general manager George Weiss, "but we won't be pressured into bringing up just any Negro player. It has to be the right one."
We've just heard 1954 by Bill Madden. Readers, I think you'll agree these titles confirm it's how you play the game that makes the difference. For more Books with Buzz, check out bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.